we're waiting, and APOC is doing their investigation. We don't think we did anything wrong, but we'll let them do the work, and we'll go from there.
A complaint against campaign ads for Bill Thomas in Haines. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 13th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, former Fairbanks Mayor Jim Whitaker comes forward regarding questions surrounding Republican Senate candidate Joe Miller's past borough employment. Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Former Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker has come forward with new information regarding U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller. Whitaker has confirmed reports that Miller was nearly fired from his job as a borough attorney in 2008 after using borough computers in efforts to push Republican Party Chair Randy Riedrich out of his position. Whitaker told the Fairbanks Daily News Miner today that Miller's use of borough property violated the borough's ethics policy. Miller was not fired at that time, he said, because the borough needed him to continue working on legal action related to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System taxes. Miller later resigned from borough employment in 2009. Whitaker would not go on tape for this story, but he said he felt obligated to come forward with the information because of Miller's head-on confrontation with Alaska reporters on Monday of this week. Whitaker said candidate Miller was not being truthful when he complained that reporters' questions were based on lies and innuendo. He said, quote, referring to the truth as lies and innuendo is not truthful. Questions regarding Miller's separation from the Fairbanks North Star Borough surfaced in July. The Miller campaign at the time released edited records from Miller's personnel file to demonstrate that Miller had resigned. When asked why he had waited until now to come forward with the information, Whitaker answered that he was waiting to give Miller a chance to come forward himself. He's not going to do that now, Whitaker said, referring to Miller's announcement Monday that he would not discuss his personal life with reporters. Whitaker served as borough mayor from 2003 to 2009. He said Miller gained access to borough computers in the days before the March 2008 convention of the Republican Party of Alaska. The borough's ethics policy states that public facilities or employment are not to be used for political activities while in work status. Randy DeSoto, Miller's campaign manager, did not return a phone call seeking comment. The state's campaign watchdog agency is considering a complaint alleging wrongdoing by supporters of Haines Republican Representative Bill Thomas. A blogger alleges a series of ads in Haines Weekly newspaper broke state rules. Tara Bicknell in Haines has more.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC, accepted the complaint filed by blogger Linda Kellen Beagle over the weekend. It's against five members of Thomas's campaign and Thomas himself, alleging potential violations of campaign disclosure law. Specifically, the complaint suggests a potential violation of the rules governing independent expenditures and in-kind contributions. The ads in question ran during the weeks leading up to the state primary election, contained photos, and ended with the name and address of one of several Haines businesses indicating who paid for each ad. They each included either a photo or the name of Representative Thomas and various wording such as thank you or vote. The complaint noted that four of the companies paying for the ads have members of Thomas's campaign on their boards. The complaint further expressed concern that photos in the ads include people in the background who may or may not be endorsing Thomas. The weekly newspaper for Haines, the Chilkat Valley News, says it billed local businesses $120 per ad, as instructed by Haines resident James Studley. Studley is also listed as deputy treasurer of the campaign to re-elect Bill Thomas, and was involved in the ad buy through providing copy, photos, and design for the ads. Complainant Beagle says it's unclear how the ads are being classified in the campaign's finances.
I couldn't figure out for the life of me what category they were gunning for when they did these ads. If they were trying to make it an in-kind contribution, they violated a number of, it looks, at least it appears they violated several Alaska statutes in doing that. if they were trying to make it independent and an independent donation, they violated statutes when it came to that. So that's when I decided that I was going to go ahead and file an APOC complaint on it.
APOC law recently changed following the Citizens United case in the U.S. Supreme Court and a subsequent Alaska Senate bill. However, the law does state that independent expenditures cannot be made in cooperation with an agent of the candidate, including a deputy treasurer. Holly Hill is the commission's executive director.
That was Senate Bill 284, and it allows now corporations and labor unions to make independent expenditures for or against a candidate. That was something that was not allowed in the past. Unlimited independent expenditures, and the only requirement is that they not coordinate with the candidate.
Those expenditures, if they pay for campaign ads, must also be reported within 10 days and follow disclaimer requirements if they run during an election cycle. Beagle, the complainant, is the blogger behind another high-profile objection, an ethics complaint against then-Governor Sarah Palin for wearing Arctic Cat jacket logos on national television. This is her first APOC complaint. She says it stems from grievances that were passed to her from Haines residents.
And it was somebody who contacted me who'd been contacted by people in Haines who'd said, there's something really kind of hinky going on here with these ads.
Studley says he's cooperating with APOC but would not comment on the complaint until a determination has been made. Representative Thomas says he doesn't think APOC rules were violated by the ads.
The complaint was filed and is under investigation by APOC. You know, the whole thing is may have violated, and so it's very generic, very permissive, and so we're waiting, and APOC is doing their investigation. We don't think we did anything wrong, but we'll let them do the work, and we'll go from there.
No hearing is yet scheduled for the matter. It's unclear if APOC will conclude the investigation into the complaint against Representative Bill Thomas before the general election on November 2nd. The full complaint is on the APOC website. Representative Thomas ran for re-election unopposed in the primary election, but faces Cordova Democrat Robert Beadle in the general election. Reporting in Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Native Brotherhood wants changes to subsistence management.
We need to be involved in at the table. Right at this point, we don't feel we have enough people that are on the board to be equal stakeholders.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The growth of virtual education in the state has spurred a building boom in Sitka. The Sitka campus of the University of Alaska Southeast is close to opening 19,000 square feet of additional classroom space, much of it wired with state-of-the-art tools for delivering distance education. KCAW's Robert Woolsey takes us on a brief tour.
The racket in the big bay of the UAS Sitka campus is a construction class. They're building a kayak shelter for neighboring Mount Edgecombe High School. The actual construction in this building is all but over. The space's campus director, Jeff Johnston, is showing me, will be occupied in November. The rooms below have sensors that turn on lights when we walk by. They also have thermostat controls that turn off the heat when no one's around. And they're equipped with cameras, screens, and smart boards to serve students who may never step on this island.
What we're doing, we're making a transition to the whole campus. 75% of our students don't live in Sitka, and so we're trying to set up so we can serve those students well. And as a byproduct, local students will get even better service.
Most Sitkans are probably unaware that UAS has built a two-story building in town. The campus is located entirely within a former aircraft hangar, a part of the Sitka Naval Air Station built during World War II. The new construction fills a corner of the hangar once used for storage and small engine repair classes. Now, most of the lower floor classroom and lab spaces will be devoted to the health sciences curriculum. Upstairs will be a student success center where advisors will help students navigate the increasingly wired world of education.
So they'll be all grouped in an area where they can provide that support for the virtual student or the online student.
But not all education can be virtual. Downstairs, there's a large room that will be furnished with hospital beds and headboards that simulate a hospital environment. There's also a king-sized bathroom where an entire class of nursing students can learn how to bathe patients. You also can't do lab work online.
So this will be our large biostorage area, and this is where we'll have all the shelves and containers so we can build all the kits that we send out for people in anatomy and phys and microbiology and chemistry.
The kits are large gray Rubbermaid totes common in Alaska for holding everything from wild game to children's toys. Johnston says the kits are an efficient way to run a laboratory program. They're even distributed to local students. Still, nothing beats the surprise of getting a special package in the mail.
Take a look and see what's in this. Unfortunately, we brought the president of the university through when someone sent back their fetal pig.
Oh.
It leaked a little bit in the container.
Just my luck, the kit Johnston shows me is full of pretty much what you'd expect for a college biology lab. He calls this a blended curriculum. Students studying to be certified nurse aides, for example, can do the didactic program online and then come to Sitka for the practical. The investment to make this possible has been about $5 million in a combination of grants. The federal Alaska Native and Native Hawaiian program provided about half the funding. The program is designed to improve the academic quality and self-sufficiency of eligible institutions. Jeff Johnston thinks that's happening.
I think it's opened up programs for students who normally wouldn't be able to access higher ed. And that's what I find especially gratifying.
On the Sitka campus of the University of Alaska Southeast, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska's opposing gubernatorial team squared off in a forum sponsored by the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday. Incumbent Republican Sean Parnell and Lieutenant Governor candidate Meade Treadwell and the Democratic team of Ethan Berkowitz and Diane Benson took turns responding to business-related questions that spanned from resource development to education. Treadwell said a Parnell administration will make the state more attractive to business.
Alaska will be more competitive because we will have a competitive oil tax, gas tax, leasing, regulatory, workforce development system that attracts investment globally and keeps that pipeline flowing.
Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate Diane Benson said she and Berkowitz have initiatives to jumpstart business, from corporate income tax cuts to a proposal that lets Alaskans invest a portion of their permanent fund in a gas pipeline.
Our ownership stake plan so that people can own a piece of the pie. Why we're standing up for small businesses so that it can be a business-friendly environment with a tax reduction and the elimination of taxes for those under $90,000.
Berkowitz, a former Democratic leader in the state House, tried to cast himself as more than a party-line politician.
I stood up to my party on ACEs and AGEA. I've stood up to my party on ANWR, and I'm going to continue to stand up for Alaska every chance I get. So on November 5th, you can have confidence that we're going to move forward in this state. We're going to do it based on common sense. We're not going to do it based on party affiliation.
The gubernatorial teams both stress the importance of stemming the decline of oil production. Parnell said that means being tough on some fronts and compromising on others.
We have to be willing to create a tax regime that is competitive. We have to have a regulatory regime that is clear and consistent. You have to have a team that is willing to stand up to the federal government, not capitulate and coordinate and cooperate all the time with them.
Parnell said he's open to several options for revamping the oil tax.
Maybe we need to think about, once again, going back to that third, third, third. The oil companies take a third, state takes a third, and federal government takes a third. At the high oil prices, that kind of a ratio doesn't exist anymore. I think we can make the North Slope more competitive. I've talked to the companies and said, let's give me those ideas on how to do it. Let's figure out if progressivity at those higher rates needs to be tweaked. Let's talk about an infill drilling credit. Let's figure out whether heavy oil is technically challenged so much that we need to do something there. So bottom line is it's about creating a climate for investment, creating those jobs for Alaskans on the North Slope through a more competitive tax regime.
Berkowitz agreed oil taxation needs overhaul, but said a single system like the current ACES tax doesn't foster development of all oil fields.
What I've proposed doing is going to a field-by-field or a project-by-project agreement where you can accommodate the individual economics of a field, of a project, in a way that that creates the appropriate incentives and allows for us to customize the approach instead of going to the one-size-fits-all that's been a problem.
The candidates also answered questions about developing Alaska through education. Both expressed strong support for the University of Alaska, but offered different visions for achieving success. Parnell heralded the new incentive-based scholarship program. Parnell said similar scholarship programs have improved student performance in 20-plus other states. Berkowitz addressed the educational approach, saying the focus needs to shift away from standardization and move toward teaching kids to think critically and help them stay in school until graduation. Officials from the Lake Peninsula Borough in southwestern Alaska will visit mining operations near Fairbanks and Delta Junction this week to help them decide whether to support development of the controversial Pebble Mine. From member station KUAC in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis has more.
Members of the Lake Peninsula Borough Assembly and other officials will be in Fairbanks and Delta for the next few days to visit the Fort Knox mine near Fairbanks and the Pogo mine near Delta. The officials also will talk with their local counterparts, including a meeting with the Delta City Council on Tuesday. Lake Peninsula Borough Manager Lamar Cotton said the visit is intended to give them an idea on how those mines are operated and how they affect the nearby communities. He said the borough, which is based in King Salmon, is much more familiar with the fishing industry, and borough officials have a lot to learn about the mining industry.
Our area is not a mining district, and you know, one of our obligations is to visit mining communities so we don't make decisions based on 30-second TV ads.
The Fort Knox is a big open-pit mine near Cleary Summit, but neither it nor the Pogo are anywhere near as controversial nor as big as the proposed Pebble Mine. Pebble Limited Partnership, a consortium of two major multinational partners, proposes to develop a massive open-pit mine to extract copper, gold, and molybdenum near what many consider to be the most productive and most sensitive salmon fishery in the world, the Bristol Bay watershed. The partners, London-based Anglo-American and Canadian-based Northern Dynasty Partnership, have not yet offered a formal plan, but their preliminary proposals have drawn heavy criticism from fishing, tourism, and environmental groups. Cotton said Lake Peninsula Borough officials want to see the two interior mining operations, talk with the operators and local officials, and get a sense of the mine's impacts on the communities. He said the Lake Penn Borough officials want to protect their fishery, and they want to make decisions based on facts, not on emotional appeals by opponents and supporters, both of whom are cranking up media campaigns to sway public opinion and local, state, and federal officials.
You know, we're sort of between two giants, if you will, the mining company and those who are heavily financing the opposition. And so we have taken the position that we're not trading our fish for a mine, but we are not going to make any final comment till we better understand, in fact, what a plan would say and what it would mean to our area.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu. Northrim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. Northrim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Lisa Murkowski officially filed today to run as a write-in campaign for U.S. Senate. She submitted her declaration of candidacy to the Alaska Division of Elections in Anchorage. Murkowski filed her paperwork in advance of the absentee and early voting in the state, but candidates have all the way up to 5 days before Election Day to become a write-in candidate. She's listed as Lisa Murkowski and did not file any other monikers or nicknames with the Division of Elections. In order for write-in ballots to be counted, voters have to not only write in the name of their candidate, but fill in the oval next to that line. Murkowski's campaign has asked the Division of Elections for clear rules about what will count as a spelling of her name. Both the division's director, Gail Finumiai, and Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell have said voter intent would likely be important, but have not given specific parameters for just how accurate a spelling would have to be. Murkowski's main opponents are Joe Miller, who defeated her in the Republican primary, and Democrat Scott McAdams. The Alaska Native Brotherhood is increasing its commitment to changing subsistence management in Alaska. The Southeast-based organization voted last week to spend more time and money to advocate for members' traditional fishing and hunting rights. As Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports, the move is prompted by recent high-profile violations cases.
Southeast Native activists have been focused on subsistence issues since several people, including Angoon Senator Albert Kukesh, were cited for harvesting violations. New Alaska Native Brotherhood President Richard Jackson says the continued effort includes the federal panel that oversees traditional hunting and fishing.
We want to have influence on getting rural users, preferably Alaska Native, on the subsistence board because of we need to be involved in at the table. Right at this point, we don't feel we have enough people that are on the board to be equal stakeholders.
The U.S. Interior Department has been considering options for the Federal Subsistence Board. A proposal released this month would add two rural seats to the six-member panel and make other changes. But it stopped short of designating those seats for Alaska Natives, as some leaders requested. The ANB plans to continue lobbying on the statewide issue and others closer to home. Jackson says delegates at the organization's recent convention voted to double last year's financial commitment, allocating $20,000 to lobbying and other work.
$10,000 is to advocate for changes in the regulation or in the federal subsistence boards, try to get inclusion of our rural users or Alaska Native preference. And $10,000 would be used in a legal defense if we fail in that.
Delegates voted to support efforts by Saxman, where they met, to keep its rural subsistence priority. The town will soon lose that status because of its proximity to Ketchikan, which is classified as urban. The ANB approved a number of other subsistence resolutions, which it will take to the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Fairbanks. One addresses concerns that changes in management of the Tongass National Forest could interfere with traditional hunting, fishing, and other food gathering. The 98-year-old ANB and ANS are much smaller than they once were. That's in part due to the growth of Native corporations, tribal governments, and health groups that share many of the same goals. New Alaska Native Sisterhood Grand Camp President Janice Jackson says it plans an effort to recruit more members as well as support those who are already active.
Sometimes that challenge is to keep people interested and involved, and that's going to be a big priority through the years to recruit new membership and keep that vitality going in our organization as we head towards our 100-year anniversary in 2012.
She says the Sisterhood plans a spring conference of local camp presidents. It will focus on parliamentary procedure, history, and protocol. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
New observer requirements and fees for Alaska's halibut fleet and smaller groundfish vessels are a step closer to approval. As KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council unanimously passed a recommendation for restructuring the Federal Observer Program last week.
The North Pacific Council's recommendation would mainly affect the so-called 30% fleet. Those are groundfish vessels 60 to 125 feet long, which only have to carry an observer 30% of the time. But for the first time, the restructured program would also require observer coverage for the halibut fleet in Alaska and for groundfish vessels less than 60 feet long. The National Marine Fisheries Service uses observers to record and manage catches and unintentional bycatch in federal fisheries. They also gather a variety of other data. According to North Pacific Council analyst Nicole Kimball, the problem with the current system is that NIMS has no control over when observers are deployed on the 30% boats, and that affects the data.
In effect, you know, inherently there's some bias in the data. You either get a lot of data in one time period, you get a lot of data at the beginning of the season or the end of the season with people trying to meet those requirements, or you get a lot of data in one area and very little in another area. So in order to deploy observers according to a statistically valid sampling plan, the agency needed to be in control of when and where observers are deployed.
So the program would not change for groundfish vessels over 125 feet, which generally have to carry and pay for one or more observers 100% of the time. Rather, the restructuring's focused on the 30% sector. NIMS has not yet determined how many of the smaller boats will have to carry observers under the new system, but all vessels in that sector have to help cover the costs of the program through a 1.25% tax on the value of their landings. Under the restructured program, Kimball expects smaller boats will be randomly selected to carry observers to collect data for a specified duration of the fishing season. And according to Kimball, the program will take into account the difficulty small boats may have in bringing an additional person on board.
In the analysis, the agency also committed to providing, you know, potential considerations for those vessels that are either just get selected and they can't accommodate an observer or some other situation, and the agency will look at that on a case-by-case basis to determine if that's possible to either get an exemption or in the future use electronic monitoring as opposed to a human observer.
While fishermen are not happy about paying another fee on their catch, Petersburg Vessel Owners Association Director Julianne Curry thinks it could have been worse.
You know, it's difficult because the halibut and sablefish IFQ fleets already pay up to 3% monitoring and enforcement fees, so explaining to them that they're going to have to pay another 1.25% is probably going to be difficult, but we were facing a 2% fee across the board, and getting that fee reduced is extremely important to the coastal economies that are dependent on commercial fishing as their mainstay.
The restructuring is still a ways from final. NIMS now has to draft specific regulations based on the Council's recommendation. Those rules will go back to the North Pacific Council and its advisors before they ultimately have to be approved by the Secretary of Commerce. The restructuring is not expected to go into effect at least until 2013. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tara Bicknell in Haines, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Alaska's first pioneer home opened in Sitka in 1913. Continuing the tradition of loving care, five more pioneer homes opened over the years, including a veterans home in Palmer. If you are 65 years or older, need assisted living, and an Alaska resident for the past year, you can apply to live in a pioneer home. Information at 888-355-3117 or at the State of Alaska DHSS website. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.